Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime.
And welcome aboard, everybody. I am the aforementioned Sal, along with my co-host, the ever-genial Eagle One, and we really appreciate y'all taking out your time today to come join us for another edition of Midrats. And for that exalted group amongst you who are joining us live, if you scroll down to the bottom of the show page, you'll find a link to the chat room. That's a great place to roll in with some of the usual suspects. And if you have some observations that you want to share during the course of the show, or if there is a question you would like for either myself or my co-host to direct to our guest because you don't think we're heading that direction, please put it in there. We'll be glad to grab hold of your good ideas and bring them into the program. If you got to head off and take care of some business and you want to catch up on what you've missed, right after the show is done, you can always get the full archive over at Blog Talk Radio. Or if you want a little more flexibility in your lifestyle, you can subscribe to the free podcast over at iTunes or Stitcher and coming to Google Play pretty soon. But hey, let's go ahead and roll on into the show. And when those study at least the Western concept of the military, depending upon which confession you come from, it's usually broken into three parts. You have the strategic, the operational, and the tactical. And especially amongst the chattering classes, everybody wants to talk about and think about the strategic level. But what really gets the stuff done at the end of the day is on the tactical level. And the tactical level ultimately requires strategy to drive it and all those connections that people get used to when they're doing their JPME or just reading up on it. But what we want to do today is we want to go to the other end of the scope and we want to go back down to the tactical level and talk about the history, the foundations, and some of the common principles to keep in mind about tactics. And we have a returning guest today to discuss this exact topic that he raises in his new book from the Naval Institute Press on tactics. And you can find a link to that book at the show page or on either one of our web pre-advertisements to the show. And that is B.A. Friedman, Captain, U.S. Marine Corps Reserve. And Brent, welcome back to Midrats.
Thanks, and thanks you both for having me on.
Yes, sir. Well, let's go ahead and bounce right into it. A lot I kind of touched on in the discussion here a second ago is especially now that we have a new administration and we have new people coming in to positions inside the leadership structure, people are talking about, you know, what's our strategy? Have we ever had a strategy? Is the strategy we're using right, wrong, or sideways? Which strategy? Everybody likes to pontificate and think about strategy. And even then, there doesn't like one is popping out that people can grab hold of. And one thing you mentioned early on in your book is the fact that in studying strategy, that whole evolution you found has been a lot easier to do than the execution in the study of tactics. And I thought for a second, you know, why when everybody is talking about strategy, 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 do we have Brett Friedman come out with a book on tactics? And how are you trying to frame this discussion?
Well, the primary reason for writing the book was to kind of put tactics in relation to strategy. Every strategist that's ever written a word has talked about tactics as well, but that was never their goal. Their goal was strategic insight. So I came at on tactics from the other angle. I'm looking at, the way I put it in the book is, I'm looking up at the mountain of strategy from the tactical level, whereas most strategic theorists look down at the tactical level from the mountaintop. And then when you take that different perspective, that allowed me, I think, to illustrate the connection between the two. And you mentioned changing administrations that almost automatically, in most cases, means that strategy is going to change. So the view from the tactical level is going to change along with strategy. All tactics flow from a strategy. So the point of the book was kind of get that across. And you'll see a lot of commenters talk about, strategic this or that. That's a strategic town in Syria that ISIS just took, or this is a strategic objective in Mosul. And a tactical objective is never strategic except in relation to a strategy. So if we find ourselves in a situation right now where we're in a transition period between two vastly different administrations, and the incumbent one hasn't released his strategy yet, how can we tell if one tactical action or another is strategic or not? We don't really know. And that makes it really difficult for tacticians to decide the best way to tackle their problems, tackle their missions at the ground level if there's so many clouds up at the mountaintop and they don't really know what they're aiming for. You also mentioned in the pre-talk that it's difficult for more difficult for a tactician than a strategist to really study tactics. And I think that's just because how much tactics change, even from day to day sometimes, and how many different types of tactics there are. You know, a strategy, it's really, there's a mostly accepted school of what strategy is and what it means, and there's debates within it, but it's bounded. It's kind of organized. Tactics isn't, and there's many different variations of tactics, like an infantry officer or a surface warfare officer, an artillery officer. They have to master different tactics at their level than each other, even. So to look at the whole range of the whole school of tactics instead of just those individual segments is something that's not easy for everyone to do. And the only way we really do it is the principles of war. And I kind of took that as my starting point and looked at all the different different lists of the principles of war and kind of examined where people agree, where different organizations agree and where they don't, and try to pick out what they were really getting at, and try to put all these different lists of the principles of war into one context under the strategic level.
Well, you, for the benefit of the people who may not quite grasp the difference between strategy, the strategic level, and I want to distinguish the operational level, because in your book you really don't seem to like the operational level as it is defined, and the tactical level. Can you kind of run through the difference between the strategic level and the tactical level? And then I'll throw you the bone and let you discuss why you not favor the operational level as it's normally defined.
So I kind of took, rather than, I had to link tactics to strategy, but rather than, develop my own idea of strategy, which would have taken another book entirely, I kind of adopted Carl von Clausewitz's idea of strategy, and I kind of even used his definition, which is the use of a battle to achieve the end state, the political end state. So strategy is much more about tactics. It's much more about, or not tactics, politics. It's much more about using the results of tactics to achieve political goals. But tactics itself is much more concerned with achieving a tactical goal, achieving a victory on the battlefield, beating a certain military organization that the tactician is presented with. So while he has to think about the strategy, his main goal is to win and keep his forces viable for the next fight. And when I look at the operational level, I kind of don't see a need for another level in between. And I wrote a whole chapter in the book on the operational level, and it really, looking especially at the American definitions, and that's really how it's been defined. Well, at some point when you've mastered tactics at a low level, you're just doing tactics at a higher level, and that's operations. and I didn't find that very compelling. I kind of turned it around a little bit, took it out of the levels of war, and examined it from an operational art perspective, and I find the concept of operational art, which is bundling tactics and supporting tactics and connecting tactics one to the other along a campaign, a lot more compelling without necessarily making it an its own level of war. You may be doing tactics over and over again, all towards one strategic goal. You're still just doing tactics. So that was the point of that that chapter on operations.
One thing I found myself doing while reading the book is I kept nodding my head and going, yep, yep, yep. And what I would offer to people is when somebody thinks about tactics, they think they're going to grab hold of a book that has a bunch of arrows over here and blocking and a lot of terrain maps, but it's not that at all. It digs deep and it's very intellectual in the best term of the sense, like you would see in a lot of books on strategy. And one of the items that and it's a topic we've touched on a variety of times here on Midrash, it has to do with how we professionally educate our people in the military arts, so to speak. And one of the things that you're almost pleading for in a few places is what you describe as a common outlook, a common set of terms, and you point out that, you know, if somebody really wanted, because words mean things, and misinterpreting words in this business can get yourself in trouble and get lots of people killed, not necessarily the ones you want. And having that common set of terms, you would think that somebody would be able to reach to a pub like JP1 and be able to find, okay, this is exactly what, when we use this term, this is what we're talking about. And anybody who's worked in international environment has heard this frustration with our allies whose English is not their second language. Is like, what do you mean by this word? And where even in our pubs, we don't properly define that term. Talk for a little bit about how you see where we might be missing opportunities or overlooking opportunities to better help people understand the entering argument to doing their job so that they can develop intellectually and understanding what they need to do and how to do it.
Well, I think the biggest opportunity, the missed opportunity, is on the officer side. We don't educate our officers until they're at the 04 level. So majors and lieutenant commanders, when they go to ILS, whatever school they get into, that's when they're expected to start cracking books on strategy and theory and stuff like that. At that point, they've been practicing for 10 years or more. And it's up until that point, we just train them. We don't educate them. And there's a quote about training and education, and who it's attributed to is lost at the moment, but it says you train for the known, you educate for the unknown. So why are we allowing our officers to go through 10 years at the tip of the spear without educating them about the unknown, just training them for the known? That's one of our huge missed opportunities. And if you compare it to other professions, like would you want to hire a lawyer who wasn't going to bother going to law school until he'd been practicing for 10 years? Or would you go to a doctor that wasn't going to bother with medical school until he'd been practicing for 10 years? It doesn't make any sense, but that's exactly what we're doing with our officers. And we go back to our allies saying, well, I hear something different from every American officer that gets deployed here, because every American officer that deployed there has a different idea about what's actually going on. There's no way for us to level the population and saying this is how we as a United States military view strategy and war and tactics, and this is what we're trying to do, and this is how we think we can do it. It's too scattershot at the moment, and that's because we defer all that education until the midpoint of that officer's career. And I think that I go into that a little bit in the book, just It's crazy, and I don't know why we do it. If I knew the answer, I'd write my own whole nother book on why we shouldn't. That's just the way it is right now.
Well, it, from your perspective, then, it's important that the junior officers and probably the senior and even the junior enlisted have a concept, a strategic concept of why we're doing whatever we're doing. And that allows them to work on the how, which is the tactical level, if I'm getting where you're going with this. Am I on the right page with that?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, we hear more and more these days about the strategic corporal, and we want them to act in a way that furthers the strategy. How can they if they have no idea what the word even means, or they got to look it up themselves? And we wouldn't send them forward with a weapon system, a machine gun, and say, well, look up yourself on how to do it. No, we train them how to do it before we send them over. But then we expect them to make strategic decisions with no training whatsoever on the front end.
Well, let me follow up on that, if you will, Sal. In the book, you state, I think, in the first part of the book that this is your intent was to write a book that be handed out to junior officers and enlisted members of units, so they could get a simple grasp of the concept of strategy and tactics and how they intermingle. And in doing that, you laid out, I think, 9 tenets of tactics, but not in the sense of a cookbook. Can you kind of discuss your tenets and what the approach is you took to thinking about how to set this stuff out?
Yeah, you know, and making that point, I never want to say, like, we don't need to create a military of strategic experts. That'd be impossible anyway. But we can give them a little bit on how to think, how to have a, you know, a cognitive framework for when they're planning a tactical action, what they should probably be thinking about, what they should be looking at. And that's what the tenets are designed to be, a cognitive framework that tell you the answer, but will help you figure out what the right questions are. So I adopted a lot of other theorists' ideas. You know, I make no pretensions that I came up with this all on my own. I adopted stuff from British theorist J.F.C. Fuller, American theorist John Boyd, and large portions of the book from Clausewitz. And so I came up with tactical tenets, which are anyone would recognize from any of the lists of principles of war. But by calling them tactical tenets, I make 2 points. These aren't really about war as a phenomenon. They're about fighting. And 2, they're not laws. They're not principles, like immutable principles. They're guideposts that you might want to take direction from, but at some point, maybe you don't. So I split them into 3 different aspects of fighting: the physical level, the mental level, and the moral level. And the physical tenets I came up with are maneuver, mass, tempo, and firepower, which is actually a new one. But I put it, I think I justified that one, a new one, pretty well. The mental tenets are shock, confusion, surprise, and deception. And then the moral level includes moral cohesion, which means how stitched together your unit is, how dedicated it is, its level of morale, and how much it can take on the battlefield, and how much damage it can dish out. So that's kind of the base of the book. And after I lay out those principles or tactical tenets, I then try to go into how they're applied in different situations, different tactical arenas that you have to think about, and how they then, you know, the last part is how to connect it to strategy.
And going from the last part to the first part, I would be remiss if I did not point out, being he's one of my favorites and has been for years, you start off the book in chapter 1 with a quote that, and you can see this stitched throughout the book. And as the Marine Corps part of the Navy Marine Corps team, I know our side of this challenge more than I know the other services because that's where I live, is we have an intentional engineered bake-in technical bias on how we recruit and train, especially our officers. And as a result, there is perhaps an intellectual imbalance in a group of people where you can sit around and you're surrounded by engineers and physicists and math majors, and you would love to have an artist or, more importantly, a historian there to balance things the other side of the brain. And part of that plea you see is a plea for an understanding and a study in the integration of history into what people are doing at the tactical level today. I'm going to do a little extended quote from your friend and mine, now Secretary of Defense, but at the time General James Mattis, U.S. Marine Corps retired, a beginning of extended quote that you start off on Chapter 1 with, and give you a chance to talk why you wanted to kick it off with this quote. Anyway, beginning of the quote: "For all the fourth generation of war intellectuals running around today saying that the nature of war has fundamentally changed, the tactics or wholly new, etc., I must respectfully say, not really. Alexander the Great would not be in the least bit perplexed by the enemy that we face right now in Iraq, and our leaders going into this fight do their troops a disservice by not studying, vice just reading, the men who have gone before us. We have been fighting on this planet for 5,000 years, and we should take advantage of their experience," unquote.
Yeah, that's that's a great quote in the first place, and secondly,
yep,
it really encapsulates, you know, General Mattis, you know, now Secretary Mattis, kind of encapsulated the whole view of the book in just that pithy little couple of sentences that it took me an entire book to say. Basically, you need to have a theory. You need to read history through the lens of a theory, and that will prevent you from being surprised and being overwhelmed on the battlefield cognitively. And it'll also prevent you, it'll help you recognize snake oil from strategy instead of paying attention to the latest craze and how we're going to beat this enemy or that enemy or how we're going to dominate this set of enemies. I mean, there's continuity in both tactics and strategy as long as humans have been fighting each other for political reasons. And he points out all of that in one quote, which is why it's the first one in the book. And that kind of informed the whole framework to study tactics, because I knew I needed to balance. I needed to come up with a set of tenets that would apply to Alexander the Great and then General Mattis in the field. And if it didn't apply to both, it wasn't really useful. And I kind of tied one of my examples is an ambush on the island of Sicily in the 4th century BC. The Syracusan hoplites used a mountain pass to surprise and ambush the cream of the Carthaginian military. There are 10,000 best soldiers, and they massacred a lot of them. And I make a couple of points from that. That tactical action had a lot of strategic effects. Even further down the line, when the Carthaginians faced the Romans in the next century, they didn't have a great military, and they didn't have a tradition of military service. They relied more on mercenaries, and that fact that they didn't have a homegrown tradition of military excellence, it's one of the reasons they failed to beat the Romans, but it's not entirely their fault. The Syracusans killed all their people that had that tradition in one ambush on Sicily the century before. And the other point is that, I connect it with ambushes in Afghanistan today. The Taliban is still ambushing our troops in Afghanistan using mountain pass, and the weapons change and the methods change a little bit. The situation changes, but the ambush is still a good tactic, and it always has been, even back to the beginning of written history. And any theory that applies the tactics needs to explain why that was a good tactic then and why it's a good tactic now. And so I try to use the tenets to explain why.
While I was reading the book, one of the things that stuck in my head kind of was, I think it's a Stephen Covey quote, but it's begin with the end in mind. And I've always looked at strategy as somebody has to tell you what, you know, what is our strategy? What are we trying to accomplish? The end. And then the delegation goes downward to the tacticians to sort out how they want to accomplish those goals. I think a quote in your book was, it's incumbent on the tactician to choose tactics that serve the strategy, and it is incumbent upon the strategist to lay out a clear, realistic, and appropriate strategy to guide the tactician. Is it also incumbent on the tactician to demand a clear strategy? And have we failed that in some of our recent adventures?
I think so. I think you're absolutely right. All of us officers, no matter the branch, we're trained to understand commander's intent. And if we don't understand commander's intent, we need to go ask for an explanation, and make sure that we understand what the commander wants, what he expects us to do, and then to carry it out. And if everyone in the military is paying attention to their commander's intent, somebody's commander's intent is coming from the commander-in-chief. And if that intent from the commander-in-chief isn't clear or isn't possible, then it's incumbent on that tactician to say, wait a minute, we need to get this right. And specifically, with all due respect, you need to get this right. Because that commander's intent flows all the way down the chain. And, I kind of pivoted off my first book, Lieutenant Colonel Pete Ellis made the same point, that the nation's decision makers need to lay out a clear, achievable strategy, because that is what will enable the guys on the ground, the guys and gals, to carry it out. And I took that from one book to the other and made the point that at some level, someone's commander's intent is the commander-in-chief's intent. So I think definitely we've been remiss in recent years. Somebody somewhere didn't do that. And it, especially if you look at books like Black Hearts, about an army unit in Iraq that had a particularly high number of atrocities and a particularly high number of defeats at the hands of the enemy. And the author specifically tied that to the fact that they didn't really know what they were doing there. So how can they make the right decisions if they don't even know why they're there, what they're doing? And that all goes back to somewhere a tactician didn't say to a commander-in-chief, you need to get this commander's intent right.
Bingo. As a former one of those guys, as an operational planner, people wonder why you have a room full of people argue for half a day about a couple of clauses in commander's intent. It's because of the second order and third order effects of not getting that right, or just having a bunch of fried air that's of no use. And over on Twitter, I promised your friend of mine there, I don't know the guy, but on Twitter, you know everybody, Remy Jimenez, he brought in a quote that I wanted to fold into another quote in the book. Everybody likes to joke, and I'm a sailor, so I use a little bit of salty words between us girls here. Everybody loves to play bullshit bingo when you've got the buzzword of the day. But there's serious implications of excessive use or poor use of jargon. And I think the critique is valid that many times you'll have jargon or a bias towards a bag of pixie dust technology to answer all your problems. And here's one of the quotes that Remy had from your book, and then I'll fold in another quote from the beginning of chapter 11 of your book. Anyway, this quote begins, quote, "This lack of strategic education has produced the United States military adrift. A college industry of shallow military thought attached itself to the Department of Defense like a parasite, selling new concepts that ranged from the specious, such as RMA and effects-based operations, to the banal, like hybrid and asymmetric warfare, to the nonsensical, like fourth-generation warfare in gray zones slash wars. An American officer corps bereft of solid understanding of strategic theory seizes on concept after concept, seeking the next shiny silver bullet that can fire to kill the specter of strategic disarray, unquote. And I would add to that, you have one of my favorite bugaboos was the age of transformation and transformationalism, where and another term that I think is being used as a Band-Aid is the third offset, where there's this, either somebody has reinvented something new that's actually been around for a while, or there's a magic technology to meet a gap when ultimately the truth of what we're having hasn't changed. And under moral cohesion, and maybe use this as a bit to talk about the moral cohesion part, which I think, like tempo, is one of the things that aren't really discussed as much as they should be. And it's from General Giap of North Vietnam. His quote was, "In war, there are two factors, human beings and weapons. Ultimately, though, human beings are the decisive factor. Human beings, human beings." What is that battle between technology and human beings that you see in the U.S. military right now?
Well, you know, I think especially with technology, it doesn't matter so much about what you can develop and what you can buy and what you can use, but how you use it. You know, today we're looking at the emergent capabilities in electronic warfare, cyber warfare, and information warfare, and these things have been around for a long time, but especially in electronic warfare, that it goes back all the way to World War One. It's just, it's matured a lot more, so that now it's a much more potent weapon on the battlefield. So you can't ignore technology, and I don't think anyone would say that you can. I mean, we can go back to John Boyd's quotes about how you need to pay attention to people, ideas, and technology in that order. If you don't, and basically what he's saying is you need to have the right people in place, and then you need to have the right ideas or concepts in place, and then you can use the right technology to achieve victory. And, you know, history bears this out. If we look at, you know, the German Blitzkrieg, as it was labeled by everyone else, none of the technology the Germans used was new, and none of it was unknown to their enemies. But they put it together. They had a better idea on how to use it, and they had a better idea on how to train people to use it than everybody else. And that's how they achieved their initial success. It's when everyone else caught up that they couldn't, you know, they couldn't close the deal. But the kind of the point of the book here is you gotta learn the good ideas, and you gotta put the right people in place before the war. You don't want to have to catch up to the Germans on the battlefield like we did the first time. We want to make the enemy catch up to us. So that's kind of how I see the interaction of technology. I didn't mean to leave it out of the book. I had no intention of saying it doesn't matter. I just think that it's been covered. A lot of people have talked about how technology works with tactics, and I wanted to talk about the ideas. The other part of the question, the moral cohesion, that I think, that's a part of your ideas, and that's a part of your people. If you're not taking care of your people, if they're not committed to the cause, if they're not willing to put in the time to get to become effective with the technology, well, then it's useless. We can go back to the Persian Gulf War, where a company of U.S. tanks would, you know, roll through a regiment or even a division of Iraqi tanks. Those tanks didn't do them any good because their people weren't committed to their cause, and they didn't pay enough attention to that. And all the technology in the world wouldn't have helped them if their troops are just going to retreat at the first sign of trouble. And then, you know, back to the quote in the book, you know, we've got another one these days with multi-domain battle, where we've moved on. Even in the last 12 months, I wrote the book, we've got a new one. And so the main point of multi-domain battle is that we have to use every domain to attack the enemy. Well, duh. I mean, why wouldn't we? And it's not really a compelling military insight. If people aren't doing that already, they should be fired. And that goes back to my earlier comment that if our officers don't have at least a base of strategic knowledge, I can't tell the difference between strategy and snake oil. And we're getting too caught up with snake oil, and we're not ever getting to a strategy that's workable, feasible, and that we can win.
Yeah, I was laughing. Lucky I had it muted because I kind of guffawed a bit. Yeah, when they started pushing that whole multi-domain angle, I'm, you know, giving side-eye to people to my left or right going, did anybody here think this is a tremendously new insight? Or, you know, it was actually, you know, I still think it's kind of pathetic. Eagle One, over to you.
Yeah, one of the questions I had about the moral cohesion in the current struggle we're having with some of these radical Islamist groups like ISIS, and their whole moral background is so different than the nation state because it's, you know, tied to their religious beliefs. How, when you're looking at tactics to convince these people not to fight us anymore, is there a way to break their moral cohesion from where you sit? This is probably too specific a question, but just curious.
Well, you know, that might be the problem. If their moral cohesion is so high, and it certainly seems to be, and especially when you mix the religion and politics in a certain way, you're going to get a high level of dedication no matter the religion, no matter the politics. And they've achieved that. But that means that their moral cohesion may not be their weak point, and we may have to go at them from other ways and different strategies. I think recently the Secretary of Defense, General Mattis, has talked about a strategy of annihilation. I think that's a recognition that, you know, we may need to use diplomatic means and informational means and economic means to attack, but you're never going to get rid of that end. You still, at some point, especially with a dedicated enemy as we're facing right now, you're going to have to kill a lot of them, and there's just no way around that. So that was one of the points I make with the tenants is they don't necessarily always apply to every plan. You know, if you are facing Iraqis stationed in Kuwait, maybe their moral cohesion isn't enough to keep them in their trenches and keep them in their tanks. But if you're facing ISIS in Mosul, maybe it is. So then you've got to take that into account. I'm not going to beat these guys at the moral level. They're not going to retreat. So I've got to pay a lot more attention to my other tenets, my physical ones, my mental ones, because that moral cohesion one isn't going to give me a weak point that I can attack. I think that's where it supplies with especially the terrorists that we're fighting right now in a couple of different states.
One thing I also really liked about the book is, like all good books do, is when you get through with it, it's prompting you to want to buy two or three other ones. And you reference a lot of people everybody should be familiar with. The, you know, from the canon, you got Clausewitz, Sun Tzu, Boyd, Jomini, the whole nine yards. We even have an Alfred Thayer Mahan thrown in there for our friend BJ. But they're also going to have some names in there that people might not be as familiar with, but you found very important. You referenced multiple times. One of them is J.F.C. Fuller. Who was J.F.C. Fuller, and what does he bring into the discussion?
Well, J.F.C. Fuller was he was a British army officer and theorist in spare time, like so many of us. But what he really brought to the tactical canon is canon is he laid out the principles of war for the first time in a real formal manner. You know, that Napoleon talked about them but didn't really lay them out, and Clausewitz talked about them but didn't really put them in a list. J.F.C. Fuller put them in a list for the first time. And after that, you saw a proliferation of lists throughout every military in the world, professional military in the world, and a lot of different theorists. So he was very influential, even if he didn't control exactly what those lists say. Everyone had their own idea of what should be on the list and what shouldn't. But what was forgotten when all those lists proliferated is that he split them into the physical, mental, and moral plane. He organized the list. It wasn't just a straight-up list. It was like a shopping list. It's a difference between a shopping list where you just write down what you're going to buy, or if you write down by where those items are located in a store. I need this from this aisle and this from this aisle. And he started out with a good organized list. Some of the principles of war were physical, some were mental, some were moral. And when that was lost, you know, part of bringing him back into the conversation was bringing that organization back. So it's not just a straight up list of all things being equal. It's organized by where you should be thinking about these things and how they affect the enemy, which I think is the important part for the tactician to remember.
One of the other things I appreciated about the book was it laid out for the first time that I've seen in quite a while anyway, maybe ever, the difference between sequential activities and cumulative actions in war. Could you kind of go through that discussion? I'm thinking for a classic example of sequential would be the island hopping campaign in the Pacific during World War II. But could you kind of talk about the cumulative stuff too?
Yeah. I kind of stole that one from J.C. Wiley, a navalist himself. And basically the difference between the sequential and cumulative is if you can, in some situations you're going to need to achieve one tactical objective after the other, like the island hopping campaign. You're going to take this island and that island and that island, and each one facilitates the next. And then they finally facilitate a strategic goal, the defeat of Imperial Japan. But a more cumulative strategy would kind of be like the Cold War, if you want to put that into hot war strategy terms. There was no good way for us to take a sequential tactics after tactics after tactics approach to eventually collapse the Soviet Union. We had to take a more cumulative approach and let things kind of build up over time until they finally tapped out, couldn't do it anymore. And that kind of helps. The tactician's never going to be in a position where he's going to choose that. That's kind of more of a strategic level function. But if he knows what his particular strategist at a higher level has chosen, then he can design his tactics at his level to support that. If you're facing a sequential, or if you're following a sequential strategy, maybe it's worth a couple more casualties to take this piece of land now so it can facilitate a follow-on operation. But if you're facing a more cumulative strategy, maybe you want to choose your tactics to preserve your forces because you know you've got a long game you've got to play. So that's kind of how the tactician should be thinking about strategy. He may never get to choose what strategy he's facing, but it'll help him decide the right decision at his level.
You know, ultimately you want to have a great strategy and great tactics that derive from them, but depending upon the personalities in play, geography, all the different variables that can come into the equation, you may not have the right matchup. And you outline where you can have the best tactics in the world, but if it's done in execution of a lousy strategy, it really doesn't make a difference. And he uses an example, the Battle of Stalingrad on the Eastern Front. Talk a bit about the really great tactics that the Germans were employing and ultimately how it just didn't make a difference. I know you did a PhD dissertation just on that, but you summarize it real nicely in the context of your book.
Yeah, it's a, you know, that at no point were the at least in the early years were the Soviets tactically better than the German officers at the lower level. They were just completely outmatched. And I use an example where they the Germans surrounded a Soviet unit that was 750,000 soldiers strong. That's what, 3.5 times a modern Marine Corps, gone in a day. They had the tactical level down. It's indisputable, just looking at the casualty list. But the strategy was so misguided. They, no matter how many times they took out 750,000 Soviet soldiers, they were never going to get there. They were never. There were always going to be more. So this, even though they were better tactically, even though they were able to take Stalingrad, they were never going to be able to hold it. Even if Operation Uranus, which the Soviets launched and surrounded the Germans in Stalingrad, even if that hadn't worked, they just would have done it again. They would have done it again. They would have kept doing it until it worked, because there was no one thinking strategically. That no matter how much better fighters we are, this isn't going to work. And the German army used to have a great tradition of strategy, but it was just completely overloaded with Hitler's Nazism and replacing all his top generals with people loyal to his politics instead of loyal to the troops that they were sending into harm's way.
Well, that kind of points to another series of questions raised when I was reading the book, which is when I had a unit, we always talked about training like we were going to fight. And I think you point out that many of the training exercises that our people go to are not I'd call them canned, but because I'm being kind, because I used to go, when we went through refresher training in the Navy, sometimes we had the same battle problem year after year after year. And maybe that's changed. I'm old now, so who knows? But how do we train our young tactical officers to recognize the tactical situations and learn to deal with them in the best way and be flexible. I mean, the whole concept of your book is we need to be a lot more flexible in how we approach these things. So is there a training regimen that you would recommend in addition to reading history and stuff, or is there where do you see that going?
Well, I'm going to step on the toes of fellow Naval Institute Press author Don Vandegrift. He's coming out with a book on mission command, and part of training to be able to execute mission command is force-on-force exercise. So rather than just going through a canned scenario where you're faced by, you know, fake targets or a script that you have to follow, which is very frequent in military trainings even to this day, you need to be fighting someone. Not for real, of course. We don't want to kill anybody. But we have the technology with lasers and computer systems that we can load up, you know, soldiers and Marines and sailors and have them fight each other in war games or exercise. And that, it's been known for a long time that that's the best way to do it. We just haven't invested in that to get us there. It seems like whenever we have to draw the military down, you know, the training and the education gets cut first so we can continue buying weapon systems. Although if we don't know how to use those weapon systems, what good are they? So if we invest a little bit more in force-on-force exercises, force-on-force training, pitting our own people against each other to help them learn and to help them compete and help them get used to making snap decisions in a competitive environment, that'll go a long way to increasing our effectiveness, no matter what we buy, no matter what enemy we face. Now, I think I mentioned in the book that the Army Training Center at Fort Irwin does this. I think the Army is the only one that really has a large scale force on force exercise. Pilots of all branches are very good at this because they can use simulators to dogfight each other. So there's still that tradition out there, but a lot of the other types of units have forgotten that. Now, especially in the Marine Corps, we're trying to bring that back. In the recent Marine Corps operating concept, talks about bringing back force-on-force exercises. There's a battalion down at Camp Lejeune that designed their own force-on-force system because they were dissatisfied with all the ones available. And we're now working on spreading that system to every other infantry battalion in the Marine Corps because it works so well. So we're making strides towards that, but we're not quite there yet. And especially when we've known for centuries that that's the best way to train units, there's no reason we shouldn't be there now, but we'll get there eventually.
Well, let me follow up. I think you mentioned in the book General Van Ripper and Millennium, was it Millennium 2000, where he engaged the swarm and made the Navy look pretty bad. We used to have fleet exercises back in the 30s where the fleet would get together and do all kinds of battle things against each other. And I know you're more Marine Corps driven than that, but is it time? Do we have a large enough Navy to have such exercises now, or are we just too spread out to be able to deal with the practical type of training like that?
Well, I think if we start teaching our officers how to arrange those kind of exercises, you can do it anywhere. Even if only one portion of the fleet is at any one station, they could do it at their level. One place that still does it in the Navy is the Naval War College. They've got, computer simulations that can that simulate the force-on-force. There's nothing wrong with the simulated force-on-force. We just need to use those capabilities and invest in that across the whole force. I think the sci-fi author William Gibson has a quote where he says the future is already here, just not evenly distributed. That's kind of what we're facing in the military now. The future is here, the future warfare platforms, capabilities, the tactics, the future training methods, they're all here. They're just unevenly distributed. Special operations and aviation units especially get the best of the best at their level, and everyone else is kind of begging for scraps right now. And if we kind of more evenly distribute the best training methods and the best equipment, we'll probably achieve a lot more success, at least at the tactical level.
Well, you mentioned stepping on toes. One thing I found interesting as well is a different view on well-known individuals. Boydians are almost cultish in some ways, and he has quite the fan base. And a lot of times when you think about Boyd, you think of him as the technical guy, because he was a technical guy. That was his side of the brain when you look at it, especially the work that he did on fighters and their development in the 70s. But when you actually look at Boyd's theory, it's not so much the technical side of the brain, but the artistic side of the brain. And that keeps coming up in the discussion of the technical side of the brain that wants checklists to memorize, vice the artistic side of the brain that wants concepts to think about and flesh out. And talk a little bit about, if you would, Boyd, not so much the technician, but the artistic side of Boyd and his thoughts.
Well, yeah, I think especially I kind of found that out. Part of my research for the book was the Marine Corps archives here in Quantico has Boyd's copy of Clausewitz. And I was able to go down and flip through it and see where he took notes and what he underlined. I actually got some assistance from his daughter who explained to me his note-taking system because it was like Greek to me. But she laid out how he used to take notes, so I could decipher that. And although he was a technician, he was an engineer, a natural one, you could say. he never ignored the more cognitive and moral side of things. And I think that bears out in his theory if you really dig into it. We always hear the OODA loop as the, you know, the observe, orient, decide, act. But it went a lot deeper than that. There were each of those levels had different components to it that not a lot of people dig into these days anymore. And a lot of people will talk about whether the decide or the act is the more important part of the cycle. But boy, they're the most important part of the cycle is the orient. Because if you observe something, but you don't understand it, then you're never going to make the right decision or the right and achieve the right action. And part of his vision of what orient was culture and background, education. Your cognitive framework allows you to orient appropriately on the situation and then make a decision and then act. And this all goes back to, strategy and the different concepts that always come out. If you don't have a good orientation of a cognitive framework in your mind, you can't observe any of that, appropriately orient it within reality, and then make a decision and then act on it. And I think that's really a key point of Boyd's theory that's forgotten when we teach a simplified version of the OODA loop.
Well, Brett, I'm looking at the clock. We're winding up on an hour here. Let me say I enjoyed the book. I've enjoyed talking to you today. What have you got in the mill that we can look forward to? It sounds like you have a lot of ideas that you're exploring, but are we going to see more writing from you? And if so, where's it going to be and when's it going to be?
Yeah, my first goal is to start up the grill here as soon as I get off the phone. Other than that, I'm currently featured. Yeah, I'm currently a featured contributor at the Strategy Bridge. So for the next, about 8 months, I'll be writing at least an article a month for them. I'm also, now employed in the civilian life as a writer at the Marine Corps Warfighting Lab and a war game analyst. I look at war games and analyze them and then come up with some of the concepts that we may be seeing in the future. So whether my name's on it or not, my writing will be out there.
Well, I just want to join in, and Brett, and thank you a lot for the last hour. We could go another hour, and I would highly encourage all of our listeners, please head on over, follow the link on Amazon, and pick up Brett's book, On Tactics, A Theory of Victory in Battle. And we'll be keeping an eye on your works coming up.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thanks again, Brett.
And thank you, everybody, for joining us another edition of MidRats. I hope everybody has a great Father's Day weekend coming up. Until the next episode, we hope everybody has a great Navy Day. Cheers.
Strand and Piccadilly, or you'll be to blame. For love has fairly drove me silly, hoping you're the same. It's a long way to Tipperary, it's a long way to go. It's a long way to Tipperary, to the sweetest girl I know. Goodbye, Piccadilly.